From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And this morning, a 72-year-old president, Donald Trump, predicted he would easily beat a 76-year-old former vice president, Joe Biden, who has officially jumped into the race for the White House in 2020.
I am a young, vibrant man. I look at Joe. I don't know about him. I don't know.
Well, meanwhile, Biden, in his first TV interview since announcing his presidential campaign, said he was sorry to women who felt uncomfortable with his hugs and to Anita Hill, who testified before him in 1991 about what she claimed was sexual harassment by then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. Let's bring in our Friday roundtable. Jesse Holland writes for the Associated Press and is a host at C-SPAN. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Doing well. And Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor, is with us as well. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, guys.
So here we are starting this weekly roundtable off talking about Joe Biden. He is definitely shaking up this race, Domenico.
Yeah, I mean, he's the big sort of boulder in the lake that we were all waiting for. He's now the 20th Democrat to get into the race, 20 for 2020, I guess you can say. And barring any other big surprises, pretty much the field is set. And I think that there's a few things that Biden has to do here to convince the entirety of the Democratic base that he deserves the nomination, because I think there are about two-thirds of the base that are open to his nomination, but there's about a third that still remain pretty skeptical of him, even though he's got very high favorability ratings, the highest, by the way, of everybody in the field. So I think the four things for me is he needs to remain disciplined, which has not always been his strength.
It's been tough for
him. He needs to answer these critics more fully. He needs to show that he can raise money and that he has the stamina to win, which President Trump was talking about.
Jesse, what do you make of the Democrats who have come out swinging already? Elizabeth Warren saying that Biden has sided with the credit card companies in the past as they tried to rewrite bankruptcy rules in the Senate. Bernie Sanders is hitting Biden for holding his first fundraiser at a home of a big money corporate donor. I mean, look, this is the first time we've really seen Democrats going after one of their own in this race.
Well, that's right. Biden is a big enough name that he becomes the target for everyone else in the primary. Before this, you've seen everyone pretty much stay apart from each other. You haven't seen any of the candidates taking on each other. But Biden, like was said earlier, Biden's the bull here. So everyone now has someone else to target on their side. Now, they all will be targeting Trump, but now they have Biden to look at as well. But, you know, Biden is also could be seen as the last gasp of the traditional Democratic politician. He's one of the old guard, and he's probably the old guard's last chance at getting a nomination on the Democratic side. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out.
Yeah, and I'll say one thing about how people are kind of going after Biden. You know, Howard Dean in 2004, when he was leading in the polls in that primary, he said at one of the debates, "Boy, you know, Howard, I realized I'm the front runner when I'm constantly pulling buckshot out of my rear end." Mm-hmm. And right now, that's what's going to happen to Biden, and we'll see if he can push through and be the person who leads beginning to end. It hasn't always happened, but it has happened often too.
Well, one of the areas of criticism that he's facing right now is about Anita Hill, who told the New York Times that she is deeply dissatisfied after speaking with Biden recently because she feels Biden is not taking enough responsibility for not letting other women testify about sexual harassment by allegations again of sexual harassment by then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas in 1991. Here is Biden talking today in his first sit-down interview since announcing on The View.
I'm sorry the way she got treated. In terms of, I never heard say, if you go back and look what I said and didn't say, I don't think I treated her badly. I took on her opposition.
Jesse, is this going to be a big deal for Biden, or is this just the story of the week? And next week we will move on to other things. He has addressed this before, but this is coming up yet again.
Here's the thing with Biden's candidacy. He starts out with everybody knowing he's a flawed candidate. He's prone to gaffes. He has a history with not only Anita Hill, but with the crime bill as well. So he starts out with everyone knowing that he could be problematic. But the question that the Democrats will have to decide is that, is he the person they're willing to stand behind to defeat Trump? Will minorities get behind him? Will the unions get behind him? Will women get behind him? If they can make that decision, then Biden could come through with it. But no one is going to fool themselves that Biden's going to be the perfect candidate for everybody.
Domenico, I can already hear what Democrats will be saying about this interview. Just go back and listen to what he said. He said, "I'm sorry the way that she got treated," not "I'm sorry the way that I treated her." That's going to be an issue for him. And you know what's interesting as well? This is already so quickly been kind of a challenging week for him.
Well, it's going to be an issue. The Anita Hill controversy is one that he's definitely – it's one of his main vulnerabilities, as Jesse's alluding to. You know, you've got the 1990s era crime bill that he's going to have to answer to and talk about. And that doesn't say anything about the half a dozen or more women who've accused him of unwanted touching and making them feel uncomfortable. And Biden said that he gets it and that personal space parameters have changed, but – again, is that going to be enough for a 2019 Democratic primary? The rationale for his case, and he leaned right into it, was about beating Trump. And Democrats lost by 70,000 votes in three states, in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And he is one of those kinds of candidates, he believes, who can win back some of those white working class blue collar voters. And the Democratic Party has always been a big tent party, but you're seeing more stridency from the party to not necessarily get behind the old guard because, frankly, in some ways, President Trump has made it so that they want to have a stronger stamp against him.
Okay, I want to ask about some of the things that are happening outside of the race for president next year. President Trump has been adopting an unprecedented strategy of refusing to comply with House Democrats' demands for documents and information on a range of subjects, from White House security clearances to recent personnel shakeups over immigration to his tax returns. Jesse, where do you see these fights leading? How far are Democrats willing to go?
Well, you will see Democrats push as hard as they can simply because they haven't had the ability to do it in the last 2 years. House Democrats are just now getting the gavels, and you'll see them use it as much as they can between now and the election. Now, for the Trump administration, their only goal is to stall until November of 2020.
Can they do that, though? I mean, the law says in the case of the tax returns that they shall furnish the tax returns.
Well, the law only says what the Supreme Court in the end says it says. So the Trump administration's plan is to get it into court.
Get a 5-4 decision in favor of the Trump administration.
And keep stalling until it gets to the Supreme Court. And as we all know, that could take 2 years or more. So right now, their goal is to litigate, and let the House Democrats scream all they want.
Domenico, the president doubling down on his claim that he never told White House lawyer Don McGahn to fire the special counsel Robert Mueller, even though that's what McGahn testified to under oath during that Russia investigation. Let's hear from the president.
If I wanted to fire Mueller, I would have done it myself. It's very simple. I had the right to. And frankly, whether I did or he did, we had the absolute right to fire Mueller. In the meantime, I didn't do it. I'm a student of history. I see what you get when you fire people, and it's not good.
Are we going to hear from McGahn, Domenico, or is this going to be another stall tactic?
Well, again, Democrats want McGahn to testify, but whether or not he does or whether or not he exerts executive privilege or the White House does is a question. But I will point out this. McGahn was, under oath. He was delivering statements to the FBI that could be, he could be prosecuted if he lied. The president has not done that. Mm. So one outweighs the other at this point.
Are you saying that it doesn't matter if McGahn testifies because, he's already on the record and under oath?
No, I'm saying if you're taking the president at his word and McGahn at his word, then the president could go under oath and he could testify. He could submit to answering that question with – the threat of the law behind him, as McGahn did. And that's not what the president's doing. So you have to take anything he says right now with a grain of salt.
It's been not even a week since the terrible Easter bombings in Sri Lanka. More than 200 people killed. ISIS claimed responsibility for those bombings. We remember, Jesse, that President Trump recently held up a piece of paper and declared ISIS defeated. It makes me wonder if he's going to face any consequence for saying that and then seeing the actions of what appears to be ISIS here in Sri Lanka. It's kind of like President George W. Bush saying mission accomplished and then the Iraq war going on for a long period after that, or is it different?
No, you have to keep in mind that President Obama also called them the JV team and had to face consequences mm-hmm. for saying that. When it comes to foreign relations, we do take what the president says a little bit differently. So he may actually face a little pressure. But once again, how many times have we had this conversation? President Trump says one thing, reality shows another, and we move on to the next story. So will he face any undue pressure over this? Probably not any more than he has for all the other things he's said in the past.
Domenico, your thoughts in just a few seconds here.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the issue in Sri Lanka was one of sharing intelligence within their own politics. And, you know, that's a situation that obviously has been mirrored in some ways in the United States with the president, you know, speaking against the quote unquote deep state with the intelligence community in the United States. So, you know, I think that it's an important relationship that the United States has with Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia partners in general. And, you know, where the president stands on that, what he decides to actually do, you know, is going to have a lot of weight and consequences.
Domenico Montanaro at NPR, Jesse Holland at the AP and C-SPAN. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Micah Meyer is about to complete his quest to be the first person to visit all 419 of the National Park Service's sites in one continuous journey. He started his road trip at the Washington Monument in April 2016. 3 years later, he is back in the nation's capital as he finishes his mission. Micah, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hey, thanks for having me again. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, and congratulations on getting this far. We've just got to make sure you get to the Lincoln Memorial on Monday so you can wrap it all up. How does it feel to be almost done?
It's sort of surreal, to be honest. I, for the past 3 years, have just been go, go, go every minute because there's always been a blog I should be writing, a photo I should be editing, or a park I need to be planning for. And I'm probably going to have to go to therapy just to learn how to turn my brain off after 3 years of nonstop logistics. So it's amazing to know that I've made it this far, and such an incredible feeling for a kid who grew up in the prairie to know that I've seen every corner of America, our most wonderful places, and am about to complete a life goal.
Well, it's interesting that you've had to spend so much time focused on logistics, because when I think about this journey in total, it seems just like it would be so freeing and relaxing to be able to spend so much time in the national parks. But you've had to do a lot of stuff along the way.
Yeah, well, everybody who says, I want to do what you do, I'm like, don't do it the way I did it, because it was just too much stress. Like going from park to park to park and fundraising the entire way and always trying to just make sure that I accomplished this insane task took away a lot of the enjoyment. You know, I'd be doing a hike and I'd be on my phone planning for the next park, setting up a meeting with the ranger a week or a month away. So definitely, if anybody wants to do what I did, I recommend not sharing it on social media at all and having the money ahead of time, because that'll make it way more freeing.
That's really interesting. So don't share it on social media. That just became a burden to you to have to take pictures of things and post it for others?
Not a burden. I mean, it was really fun to be able to share this with the world and to see people's reactions and see their excitement. So that actually, when I got really lonely on the road, kind of kept me going. But it was tough because sometimes it felt more like I need to put out a product versus experience this for myself.
Okay, so that aside, what was the most incredible thing you saw along the way?
Oh man, that's tough to pick. There were so many insane moments of just pure natural beauty where you're looking around saying, is this real? Like, is this view real? Is this moment real? Is this place real? I remember driving through Big Bend National Park in Texas and just constantly repeating that as I drove up to the Chisos Mountains, because it was such a magical moment. Or standing looking over Half Dome at sunset and the sun actually leaves and like 95% of the people there all take off, but then they miss twilight. And you're looking around thinking, I can't believe everyone left and that I'm still here and getting to experience this and didn't follow the crowds.
This is Half Dome at Yosemite, right, in California.
Yeah, yeah.
And were you taken to every single state in the country?
Yep, every single state and all the territories. So everywhere from the Arctic Circle of Alaska to American Samoa to the easternmost point of the United States and the Virgin Islands and Guam, where America's Day begins, along with the Northern Mariana Islands.
Wow. Where did you spend the most time?
That's tough. I mean, I was sort of constantly on the move. So California has the most parks, but Alaska has the second most, and I spent 77 days there doing their 23 sites. That was my hardest state by far, financially, emotionally, and logistically. Only 5 of their 23 sites can actually be reached with a vehicle, so the other ones take bush planes, boats, and backcountry tours. Mm-hmm. So it was a stressful and fulfilling summer when I knocked Alaska off the list.
What do you mean by it was the most difficult emotionally?
Just because, you know, everyday things would change, and there was one park, actually the least visited park in the entire National Park Service, Aniakchak National Monument. More people climb Mount Everest every year than go to this park, mm-hmm. and that's because to get there, you have to take a multi-$1,000 bush plane, and the weather has to be perfect in 3 locations, in the park, in the takeoff location, and everywhere in between. And it's on the Aleutian Islands of Alaska, so the weather is just so volatile that you could take off and not make it. And the pilot says, look, you're paying either way. So Alaska and its weather and its cost just made it stressful in a lot of ways.
Did your life outside the parks get in the way at all during this whole journey? I mean, that's a few years you've been on the road. Did you ever have to just deal with some crisis that was going on not in the parks?
Totally. And that was the hardest part, is you'd be out in the middle of nowhere and I get an email from my insurance company saying, you know, you need to sign this form. And so I'm thinking, okay, how do I get internet? How do I get secure internet? How do I sign this? How do I upload it? And then suddenly an entire day is taken over with this mundane task that might usually take 5 minutes if you had a house with an address and a computer. So yeah, definitely life moments got in the way every so often, but that's part of it.
Did you have any run-ins with wildlife along the way?
Fortunately, I did not get attacked and eaten by a bear. That was one of my number one concerns of this whole journey. Actually, in Katmai National Park, that's where all the bears are. The famous photos you've seen are Brooks Falls with just tons and tons of bears eating fish. So there were certainly those moments. But the Park Service does a great job of keeping guests safe, keeping the animals safe. So I did not sort of have the mountain lion that I had to strangle with my hands like we saw in Colorado. Fortunately. So thank you to the Park Service for keeping me safe.
Did you see any really cool wildlife?
Oh my gosh, tons. I think in Alaska, I saw everything but a polar bear. And just driving to Alaska and back, there would be bears on the side of the road. There were moose on the side of the road. It was like this constant zoo almost. It really is a wild place compared to the lower 48.
One of the things I've noticed when I've been in national parks, and I was just in Joshua Tree a couple of weeks ago taking a hike, and I noticed that a lot of the people that are in our national parks are from other countries, that in a way, people from around the world have more of an appreciation for the natural beauty of the United States than many Americans do. Did you notice that?
Totally, especially in Utah, in the Mighty Five. They do such a good job of marketing them internationally that I heard more foreign languages than I did English. Hmm. So it's been fascinating to go to these really well-known popular places and experience that, which is why I'm a big advocate for sort of going beyond the 61 capital N, capital P national parks and looking at these 419 sites that I did on my journey, because some of my favorite places that I went were not the ones you've read about in the magazines, were not the ones that you see all over Instagram, and that made them almost more special to not only feel like I was finding these hidden gems, but then to physically be there and be standing at the incredible sunset and not have any screaming kids around me.
Now, when you were on our show in 2017, as you were starting this journey, you explained that one of the reasons you were doing this was to be an LGBT role model.
Yeah.
Do you think you've been successful at that during this project?
Totally. It's been such a roller coaster ride. You know, I started this journey thinking I had to go back in the closet to sort of be that outdoorsy person that America imagined and that America would want to support. And after about 9 months, that wasn't really working. And so I got this message from this 15-year-old who said, I go to a private Baptist school in Texas. I'm not out of the closet to anyone, but I read about your journey and saw you're setting world records. And now I know when I grow up, I can be ordinary and extraordinary. Hmm. And it sort of changed everything to me, knowing now that I needed to be that LGBT role model that didn't exist. And so I put a huge focus into that. And unfortunately, one of my greatest fears came to being later that year, where a sponsor who had been supporting this project dropped me and put in writing it was because I was doing too much LGBT outreach. So I sort of had to come to terms with that. But the beautiful thing is, an individual heard about this and gave me my largest donation of this entire project. Mm. And he said, it's because you are doing this LGBT outreach. It's because you're creating this new role model. And this past October, actually, for the first time in the history of the outdoors industry in America, or the outdoors recreation industry, a company featured an openly gay man in an outdoors campaign. And that was me with REI as part of their Opt Outside campaign. Mm. So from starting this journey thinking I had to hide that I was gay to fit America's mold, to now being able to use this journey to create a historic role model that did not exist before this journey, is an incredibly humbling and amazing feeling.
So once you finish at the Lincoln Memorial on Monday, where are you going next?
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to having a normal life after a few years of not being able to go on a second date or see my family on the regular. I've really learned the value of that and sort of the little things, how important they are. But I will be relocating, taking my van to Minneapolis, where I will be living while I write my book. And I will be planning for my next epic road trip. I'm currently looking for a philanthropist or a sponsor who wants to make my next big project possible, which is following a college football team to every game this fall season to continue shattering stereotypes about what gay men like and don't like.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting also that after seeing every part of this country that you have settled on, Minneapolis. That must speak highly of Minneapolis.
I know. It's so funny. Everyone's like, really? Do you know how cold it is?
No, it's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful city.
It totally is. And this is going to sound cheesy, but what this trip to all of America's most beautiful places has taught me is that they really don't mean a darn thing if you don't have someone to share them with. And so as I have spent 3 years as a nomad, I've learned that I really want to focus on my personal life now and having one again. And the people I've met in Minnesota and the experiences I had there have made me believe that that's the best place for me because of the people.
That's Micah Meyer, who is completing his quest to visit all of the National Park Service's 419 sites on one road trip. Micah, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave. Control your comfort.
Mozambique has been struck by another devastating storm. Cyclone Kenneth's strength was downgraded today, but it made landfall last night with 140-mile-per-hour winds. The southern African country is still recovering from a cyclone that killed more than 1,000 people just a little over a month ago. And now the United Nations is predicting another round of massive flooding. The BBC's Pumza Fulani is in the capital, Maputo. Pumza, the UN, also says this is the first time in known history that Mozambique has been hit by two storms like this in one season. How much damage has Kenneth done?
At the moment, Peter, the authorities here in Mozambique are still out, and they've sent out their teams to the northern part of the country to try and do damage assessment. They're saying it's still too early to get a clearer picture of the devastation. But looking just at the sheer force of Cyclone Kenneth, they are bracing themselves for widespread damage. There are also huge concerns about flooding and landslides. And some of the areas that have been hit by Cyclone Kenneth are already prone to flooding in normal weather, in just normal rainy weather. And authorities here are worried that these circumstances will make rescue efforts incredibly difficult for people here.
We're reading that this latest storm could drop more than 20 inches of rain, which is more, by the way, than last month's cyclone, which did a tremendous amount of damage. So are people prepared for that?
In a lot of ways, sadly, Peter, they aren't. And one of the reasons for that is Mozambique is an incredibly rural country, and some of the villages are spread out, and people either would not have heard on time that the cyclone was coming, or simply would not have understood the impact of what was coming. As you say, this is the first time in known history that a cyclone of this magnitude has come so close in succession of a previous cyclone. So for a lot of people, they simply would not even have had the means to get to safety or the resources to get to structures that would have been able to withstand the force of what's happened. And what the authorities here on the ground are worried about is not so much the cyclone that hit overnight, but the rains that are anticipated over the next few days into a week. They say that is likely to cause the most damage here, and people are likely to be trapped in their villages because of that rainfall.
And how close was the landfall of Kenneth compared to last month's storm? In other words, are the same people getting hit a second time?
The place where the cyclone has hit this time around is further north up country. In fact, as far as authorities can tell, this is the first time that they've had a cyclone that far up country, which also means that the people there would not have been able to prepare. The good news, I suppose, is that it means this isn't the second time that they've been affected. But authorities are hoping to use the lessons learned from the rescue efforts around Cyclone Idai just last month and see if they can do things a lot quicker, if they can get to areas a lot quicker.
And how is recovery from that storm going? I know there was a serious cholera outbreak, and now the concern is malaria.
Correct. That process is still ongoing. And as we understand at this stage, that is fairly under control. They are happy with the progress that they're making there. The next focus now will be on how soon they can get to the people out in the northern part of Mozambique and what sort of help they will need and whether they will be able to raise the resources needed to respond to something like this.
That's the BBC's Phumza Fulani in Maputo, Mozambique. And now recovering from a second major cyclone to hit that country in the past 2 months. Phumza, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Peter.
The future of Baltimore's mayor, Catherine Pugh, is in doubt after federal agents raided her home and office yesterday in connection to payments she received for a self-published children's book. The entire city council is calling for her resignation. But just last month, elected city leaders were united with the mayor when she signed a law putting strict pollution limits on the incinerator that burns most of the city's trash and converts it into electricity. Yesterday, we went inside that building and spoke with the plant's managers, who defended its safety record. Today, as a part of our series Going to Waste, we'll take a closer look at the activists who oppose it. And we'll start here, at this festive gathering of taxpayers near Baltimore's City Hall. It's where people like Melanie Thomas recently stood up in front of a microphone and told city leaders to stop paying the Wheelabrator incinerator to burn trash.
This incinerator is propped up by public subsidies and public resources reflected in our city budget that relegate communities like mine in South Baltimore as a dumping ground on top of the air pollution. Curtis Bay has hundreds of vacants that pile up with illegal dumping and residential roads clogged with diesel truck traffic spewing fumes.
Long before this event, the activists had found an ally in City Councilman Ed Reisinger. He sponsored the ordinance that passed easily back in February. It'll force Wheelabrator to constantly monitor 20 pollutants and drastically reduce other toxic emissions by 2022.
It didn't just affect those communities that were close to the incinerator, but it really seriously depended on which way the wind blew. You know, if it was a windy day, it could go south, north, east, or west.
Reisinger was an unlikely ally because even though he lives in the district where the plant operates, he never paid much attention to it.
Yes. Have people been talking to you about it over the years, complaining to you about it, trying to pin their asthma or their health conditions on the pollution that the plant was putting out?
Yes, you're correct. But, you know, I would hear them. I have to admit this. I'm being humble. I would hear them, but I wasn't listening.
Why weren't you listening?
Because when you see it coming out of the smokestack, you just see the smoke. You know what I mean? You could drive through the city, you see the prostitutes, you can see boarded up houses, you can see drug dealers. But I never really read anything about the pollution. People would talk about it, and then the more I read into it and realized, you know, the detriment they were to the city, it was like, you know, it's got to be closed.
Was the bill designed and written so that Wheelabrator, the incinerator, would shut down? Was that the goal?
That was my narrative and directive, was to shut down Wheelabrator.
Wheelabrator will either have to install expensive new pollution controls or shut down. Instead, it's taking the fight to court. The company's Mike Dougherty tells me the plant meets state and federal emission standards, provides renewable steam energy to downtown homes and businesses, and that other forms of pollution do far more damage to the neighborhood.
You can see where we are in the neighborhood. We have 395, 95, and 295. The NOx emissions from mobile sources, from cars, trucks, et cetera, are far greater than the emissions from this facility.
Environmental organizations on this aspect, they are anti-environmental.
Nicholas Themelis is a professor of earth and environmental engineering at Columbia University, who says the activists who want to shut down waste-to-energy plants are misguided.
For some reason, I think it's something left over from the 1980s when incinerators were a major polluter because they didn't have the right controls. You understand? We did not know about mercury. We did not know about dioxins. Okay, so I think that has been a leftover.
It is true that in the 1990s, the EPA forced waste-to-energy operators to retrofit their plants with new pollution controls. But activists like Destiny Watford aren't convinced it's enough.
We should all be pragmatic and think critically about this, right? Because what we do in this moment will unfold how the future of waste looks like in Baltimore. Like, we could continue to support this incinerator or expand our landfill and support dirty developments, or we could change the game.
In 2016, Watford won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize. When she was still in high school, she led a crusade to stop the construction of a new incinerator in her neighborhood, which is already one of the most polluted places in Baltimore.
And long story short, we won after 5 years of fighting.
I sat down with Watford outside City Hall.
What's your beef with them? What's wrong with incinerators from your point of view?
Incinerators poison our air and put our lives at risk, especially those folks who live in poor neighborhoods like Curtis Bay, where I grew up. And the thing is, this is happening. People's lives are being put at risk for no reason. For example, the majority of the waste burned at our incinerator could be recycled or composted. Over 80% of it could be recycled or composted.
Do you believe that it impacts your neighborhood more than the rest of the city?
I do. The incinerator is located in South Baltimore, where my neighborhood is located. In fact, there was a study conducted that showed that the deaths related to air pollution in Baltimore is higher than the homicide rate in the city. And specifically, when you live in South Baltimore communities like Curtis Bay or Brooklyn or Westport, you can expect an entire decade to be shaved off of your life just simply because of where you were born.
But how do you know that's because of the incinerator?
That's a good question. And it's one that we get asked a lot. We know that because of all of the polluting industry that surrounds our neighborhood, not just the incinerator, but also the medical waste incinerator, our landfill, other dangerous, hazardous, polluting developments in our communities, all of these things build up.
Have you noticed that? Do you feel less healthy?
Yeah. My mom, for example, last year, and I hope she's okay with me mentioning this, almost died because she had an asthma attack. It would be easy to say, well, you can't pin that back to incineration, but what I can tell you is that there is a real cumulative impact when we think about the polluting developments that happen and exist in poor neighborhoods like Curtis Bay.
I spoke with the managers of the incinerator, and they told me, look, our emissions meet EPA standards, and that the incinerator is a green form of energy and should be used as a way to get rid of trash in this city, that it's a good thing.
The reality is, even if that is true, that they meet the standards, people are still dying because of air pollution. People are dying from respiratory disease and high levels of asthma. And the history of our neighborhood, if we go back, will show us the same history. So to that, I say it's not good enough.
But here's the problem, and I'm sure you're well aware of this. The trash has to go somewhere. This city creates a lot of trash. Every city in this country creates a lot of trash. And your landfill is filling up. Uh-huh. Your incinerator isn't the solution, according to you. What is the solution? Because you have to do something with all the waste this city is creating.
I agree. It's not enough to just shut the incinerator down, because at the end of the day, we create a lot of waste. And I think when we're thinking about alternatives, it also includes a just transition away from incineration and toward alternatives like recycling and composting. I'm talking like our food scraps, right? Or our paper, cardboard, all of these things that aren't really waste and can be used again.
Even the incinerator managers agree that they're burning a lot of recyclable or compostable materials. But the problem is, again, how do you get an entire city to compost? I mean, you have to do it the right way or else it doesn't work. China has stopped taking the United States recyclable material, so there's no market for it anymore.
Yeah.
It also just isn't so simple to say compost and recycle.
Exactly, yeah. So when we say, hey, we need to do recycling and composting, that needs to be backed up. It needs to be backed up by the resources that we pour into these projects and these ideas and this plan to do zero waste in Baltimore in a real way. It can't be treated as some after-school special or a fluff piece for a grant that you're writing. Like, it needs to be real and it needs to be concrete. And that's been ignored for a long time, and we need to change that.
The city is trying to change. 2 years ago, the Baltimore City Council adopted a zero waste resolution, a vision to send as little as possible to the landfill. But the resolution is non-binding, and the city is still working on a 30-year plan to rethink the way it manages the 1.2 million tons of waste it produces every year.
The Commerce Department reported today that U.S. gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 3.2% in the first quarter, a significant bump up from how it ended last year. Mike Regan is senior markets editor for Bloomberg. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So a lot of analysts were expecting GDP growth around 2%. This is a significant revision up. What is driving it?
Well, it's important to sort of recognize what the trade deficit means for GDP growth. Exports are good for growth. Imports are a drag on growth. And the theory going around a lot of economists is that at the end of last year, a lot of companies became worried about the trade tensions going on, and they imported a lot of raw materials and components towards the end of 2018. So then in the first quarter of this year, they didn't need to import as much. And at the same time, they really built up their inventories, which is another boost to growth. So if you sort of take those two elements out of this report, a lot of economists don't think it's as robust as it first seems. For example, personal consumption, just the technical word for consumer spending, it only increased about 1.2%, which was one of the lowest readings in the past 5 years. So it's kind of a good headline number, but in the guts of the report, it's not as strong as it looks.
Something else I want to ask you about, Mike. Uber is going public and will reportedly seek a valuation between $80 and $91 billion. That's actually lower than investors had expected, but that figure would still make Uber the biggest IPO out of Silicon Valley since Facebook. Is the valuation dropping because of Lyft's IPO? Lyft is now trading more than 20% below its issue price.
So Uber didn't actually come out and say that explicitly in their filing, and Bloomberg hasn't actually reported that as fact. But it's certainly the assumption and the whisper on Wall Street that Lyft's experience had a big influence on the pricing of Uber's IPO. And if you look at the valuation of Uber in this filing, it's at about 8 times the company's annual revenue, which puts it very close to Lyft's valuation. So the thinking is that, yeah, Lyft did have an influence.
Okay, stand by, Mike, because Uber and Lyft have been in the news this week in Massachusetts because, like in many places, the taxi industry is not happy about the competition. And now regulators are changing the rules for Uber and Lyft at Boston's Logan Airport. They're now going to have an extra drop-off fee and most of the time won't be able to take passengers directly to the terminals, but rather to a central parking location. Here's Quincy Walters of member station WBUR.
The board of the Massachusetts Port Authority, the agency that manages Boston's Logan Airport, has added a drop-off fee and eliminated curbside service during most of the day. The new rules are an effort to reduce congestion and pollution, and they don't apply to traditional taxis because airport managers say Uber and Lyft vehicles far exceed taxis. But Felipe Martinez of the Boston Independent Drivers Guild says he feels ride-hailing drivers haven't had a say in this.
We would just like to be included as drivers. So we just want to come, maybe start a dialogue, because we are having a difficult time as drivers, in some cases making ends meet, driving people.
Airport officials contend the new rules will benefit drivers. They say a central ride-hail location will eliminate the need to drop off passengers at terminals, then leave the airport with an empty car, only to circle back. Now they'll be able to drop off passengers and pick up new ones all in the same spot. And there seems to be a bit of a compromise. Between the hours of 4 a.m. and 10 a.m., Uber and Lyft drivers can drop passengers directly at their terminals. Still, the new rules didn't sit so well with board member John Nucci.
I would have liked to perhaps seen us not compromise on the morning drop-off, but the board has seen fit to do that, and now we'll have to monitor it closely. It all depends on whether or not it changes the behavior of drivers.
And there's another compromise. Airport managers originally sought a $5 drop-off fee. The board settled at $3.25, and just $1.50 if you share your ride. The new rules could change if they're not working out, says board member Laura Sen.
And like any operational plan, it's a plan. We have not any solid evidence of how this will work. So I think that the public should all be aware that this is the beginning of the plan. And the plan may have a lot of other parts, and a lot of the parts may change.
This is all untested, says Uber spokesman Harry Hartfield. He says it'll cost the airport millions of dollars to create a new ride-hailing area, and he says Uber has offered alternatives to reduce congestion that have gone unconsidered. Despite the opposition from ride-hailing companies, the proposal passed unopposed. But board members say they want to monitor the impact. Airport officials say they want to minimize the inconvenience for people with disabilities and challenges with mobility. The changes are expected to take effect in October. For Here and Now, I'm Quincy Walters.
So, Mike Regan at Bloomberg, what do you make of that? There's a lot going on there, and this is something that airports around the country and regulators around the country are dealing with.
Well, right, and Uber's revenue from airports is something like 15% of its revenue, so it's a big deal. But it's really one example of sort of many lobbying efforts going on by taxi companies to make Uber comply with this sort of patchwork of local regulations. And it's had some effect. For example, in 2017, London actually refused to renew Uber's license.
Right.
So they got it back for a temporary basis, but it's not clear if they'll get it back again. So it's the taxi cabs are a huge lobbying effort against Uber for sure.
And we'll see what works best at airports. Mike Regan, senior markets editor for Bloomberg. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.